The Secrets of Stargate is brought to you by the StarQuest Production Network and is made possible by our many generous patrons. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit sqpn.com/give.
You're listening to The Secrets of Stargate, episode 156.
General West, Jackson has identified the seventh symbol.
All right, here we go. We are about to try to make a connection.
All we gotta do is bust out of here, commandeer the ship, and fly on home.
Indeed. You say that a lot.
I know that this could be dangerous. But this is our job, right? It's what we signed on to do.
It was never about going home. It's about getting us to where we're going.
Hi, I'm Jack Berezini, and you're listening to The Secret to Stargate, where we talk about the hidden meanings and deeper layers found in the Stargate movies, TV series, and more. And joining me today are Lisa Jones. Hi, Lisa.
Hey, Jack.
And Victor Lambs. Hey, Victor.
Hey, Jack. Just at the outset, I want to just mention for anybody who might be listening to this podcast and not watching the video, I have a giant bug attached to my neck, so if my voice sounds different or sounds weird, that's probably what's contributing to it. I just didn't want people to worry. It's just a giant bug attached to my neck.
Yeah, I wasn't going to say anything because, I mean, there's a lot of different fashion trends nowadays, and I don't know if it could have been like a sensitive medical subject, but I'm glad you pointed
that
out.
I appreciate that. Yeah, I mean, it's when you go out, you could tell who wants to ask about it but isn't. And then, you know, usually it's kids who say, hey, you have a giant bug attached to your neck, but the adults are a little bit more tactful. But, you know, kids got to love them.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad that you seem to have accepted this new role in life.
Yeah. I mean, it should be dropping off. How long has it been on? Like 14 minutes? Another 24 minutes, I think it should be coming off there.
Nice. That's right around 38 minutes, which
yeah.
Just happens to be the episode of Stargate Atlantis that we're discussing. It's the fourth episode of season one. And I feel like science fiction shows that have a length of time in the title that's your ticking clock tend to be good, because 33 minutes, the Battlestar Galactica episode is one of the best. And this is a really good episode of Atlantis, too. And essentially what happens in this is that the puddle jumper coming through the gate gets stuck, which, to be honest, I'd wondered about. So I'm glad they're actually making a plot out of that, because that's a pretty tight squeeze. You got to pull in those pods and thread the needle exactly, as they say. And yeah, it gets wedged halfway in between, which means we get to learn a little bit more about how the Stargates work. Apparently, if you're stuck halfway in between, you just stay in a dematerialized state, which might be nice sometimes. I don't know. But Shepard has a bug stuck to his neck. I don't know if that was difficult for you to watch at all, considering your situation, Victor.
It was borderline triggering. Yeah.
Yeah.
Should have had a warning at the beginning. You know,
it should have. They tend to do that with TV shows nowadays that are older, yeah. So they might have put one there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's the ticking clock is how to get the puddle jumper out of being wedged in the Stargate, so we don't lose Taylor and McKay and Shepard all the while dealing with the bug situation. This is a really good episode. I enjoyed it. What were your thoughts on it, Lisa?
Mm-hmm. I really enjoyed it. When I love episodes like this that start and you think, did I miss something? Was there another episode in between the last one and this one that I just didn't see? Because it just, you just jump right into, they're in this puddle jumper and Shepard's got the thing on his neck and they're all, and you're going, wait a minute, what? So I love that. I like the, like you said, the ticking clock. And the way that we are introduced to all the scientists, mm-hmm. some of which you will love and some of which you love to hate. And you see Weir, you know, be strong and stand up for herself. And so it's just, it moves much faster than 38 minutes for me.
Yeah. I do like how I feel like they kept the time pretty, pretty accurate to the actual 38 minute mark, because the episode itself is like 45-ish minutes, so mm-hmm. I like that. They actually paid attention to that. I was happy to see Zelenka. He's so much fun.
Yeah.
What about you, Victor?
Yeah, it's an excellent episode. The pacing, they keep the sense of urgency up from the commentary. That was, you know, the director, Mario Ezzopardi, really, you know, kept the intensity going. with the cast. We do get introduced to two of my favorite characters, scientists on the show, one of whom sticks around, one of whom has a couple more appearances and then doesn't stick around. But it's a really good episode. We learn a lot about the Stargate, a lot about it, you know, the puddle jumpers. And it's a really good episode where pretty much everyone on the team contributes something towards the solution. And I really like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Nah. Yeah. Just right off the bat, I can't stand Dr. Kavanaugh already, but I think that's the intended effect.
You're not
effect.
Meant to.
Right. So. You love to hate him.
Yes.
Or
yeah.
Wish he would go away. Either one.
Both, maybe. Awesome. Yeah. I feel like this is because we've already had like seven seasons of it, of SG-1 doing the exploring the planet of the week thing. They're really taking advantage of the different setting we have here with Atlantis and mm-hmm. doing different interesting things with this. Atlantis almost feels more like your typical space exploration kind of show, because it is set in space more or less. You get more technology than we've had in SG-1. So it's cool to see essentially the shuttlecraft is going to explode episode of a Stargate franchise and kind of get more into that.
And so quick off the bat too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Not only is the shuttlecraft going to explode, but the people in the front of the shuttlecraft, are they still alive? Are they like derezzed? Mm-hmm. What's going to happen to them? You know, and even if the gate shuts off, they might be lost, but then everybody else will be lost too, because they'll be exposed to the vacuum. And I guess this was filmed over the course of, you know, seven filming days, five and a half of which were in the puddle jumper set, which was as claustrophobic and as closed in as it appears in this. They later kind of revamped the set so it's a little bit more comfortable to film in. But those actors were basically five full days in that little puddle jumper thing doing their lines. And at some point, you know, they have flashlights that they're shining in each other's faces because that's the only lighting for that particular scene. So in addition to remembering their lines, they had to shine flashlights into that the right person at the right time. Joe Flanagan apparently hated this, doing this episode, because he's just, you know, on the floor with a bug attached to his neck for, you know, 5 days. We get some flashbacks, which are cool, but you could tell the actors, you know, I mean, you can't tell the actors are uncomfortable, but some of that discomfort, I think, comes through to the characters as well, which mm-hmm. is good.
Yeah. I also like that we get the different ways the characters are dealing with the situation. And of course, McKay is, as is his wont, completely freaking out about it.
Mm-hmm. First thing he does is go negative. There's no way, we can't fix it, we're all dead. And then it's just like when everyone starts believing that, then he's like, no way, let me go to work and fix it.
Yeah.
And apparently David Hewitt is also claustrophobic. That's one thing they mentioned on the commentary. So a lot of that discomfort was probably not acting.
Nice.
I will say, when he's like, I'm going to hypoglycemic shock and I need food, you know, and they throw him a candy bar or whatever, and they all look at him with just this. It was just the most amazing moment of all the actors looking at him like, seriously? Yeah. And he's like, what?
I almost wondered if that was like ad-libbed. Yeah. Is their reactions. But it does keep up the motif of him constantly eating.
Yeah.
Although I was surprised, because when they're like, the candy bar comes from like their supply kit, which they're going through stuff to try to get the bug off of Shepard's neck. And they've tried all the different things, like shooting it with a gun and trying to cut it off. And the whole problem is that it's essentially a wraith bug and it can regenerate. And every time it regenerates, it's sapping his life force away, a la Princess Bride. But the fact that they specifically mentioned the chocolate bar among the, I think they had iodine and like rubbing alcohol and a defibrillator. The fact they mentioned the chocolate bar, I almost felt like it was Chekhov's chocolate bar and that was going to be what would cause the bug to drop off. So I was kind of sad that that wasn't.
Yeah. He just needed to put it into a sugar coma or something.
Yeah. Right. Just rub chocolate on it and it'll die.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was waiting for that. But, oh, well.
That would have been great.
Yeah.
Yeah. But like I mentioned, everybody has something to contribute in this episode. And we really see Dr. Weir stepping into her role as leader because she has to deal with so much. She has to deal with Rodney, Major Shepard being down, you know, Dr. Kavanaugh, Holland, you know, everybody kind of needing something from her. And she has to keep them all on task and focused, you know. And so it's a really good, strong Weir episode. I think this is one of her better episodes.
For sure. And at the same time, she's just going from one to the other. And you do kind of feel for her because she can't like go to in the lab or science and figure it. Like she can't come up with the solution herself. She can't manage. She's just managing everybody else, which, you know, it did show her not just authority, but the way that she remained calm and strong and able to manage all of these different people.
And contrast this with what we saw with Jack last week in Zero Hour, right? Where he's similarly over his head, but he is not handling it nearly as well as Dr. Weir does in this episode. You know, eventually he gets to the right solution, but he has 5 days. He doesn't have just 38 minutes in this case, but or 35 minutes, you know, by the time that they just determine what's wrong. But
and I did read that if you time it from when they get stuck to or when I don't know if it's when the gate opens or when they actually get stuck, but to when they go through, it is actually 38 minutes.
Oh, nice.
That the episode is timed for 38 minutes. So I thought that was kind of cool. So it was the only time they've done that in SG-1 or Atlantis.
I feel like often with movies, you get the time gets stretched. Like I always think of the example from Independence Day, which I guess Roland Emmerich. So it's tangentially related to Stargate. That like 30 seconds at the end when they're blowing up the alien ship is really like 2 minutes and like 48 seconds or something. Like,
yeah.
So it's nice they actually kept it to that.
Yeah. I was watching the original Men in Black yesterday and, you know, they have an hour to basically to save the world from destruction. And they go into the, you know, the tunnel to Queens and they're driving along. And I think that's like, you know, they have 50 minutes or something left at that point. And then by the time they get out of the tunnel, they have 8 minutes left, which I thought was nice. You know, it's very realistic. It's like, you know, it would have taken you even in a rocket car, you know, 40 minutes to get through the tunnel, you know. So I thought, you know. But yeah, I always like that. And they didn't have to put up like a timer in the corner like they did on 24 or something to say, oh, how much time do we have left? They do a good job kind of, you know, explaining that. But
they convey the urgency to the point where towards the end when after Zelenka, yeah. I keep wanting to say Zelensky, but Zelenka, after he discovers how to bypass the control system to retract the pods. And I also just like that he's like head down, just working on the technical stuff. But he relays that to Rodney, who starts working on that. And there's a few points because that's parallel to that is when they are trying to get the bug off of Shepard and they end up using the defibrillator. And there's a few times where you can see Rodney's just like looking back and watching what's going on. And like, I actually like yelled at the screen at one point. It's like, come on, Rodney, do your stuff. You're going to run out of time.
Focus.
Yeah. So they did a good job of pulling you into the time there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, I should mention at this point, Zelenka does become one of my favorite characters. I don't know that this is intentional or not, but the name Zelenka, there was actually a 17th or 18th century Baroque composer named Jan Dismas Zelenka, who at the time he was writing music had been, I think he was a court composer and then had fell out of favor, had been forgotten. He would write masses and, you know, beautiful Kyries and stuff. He would write all this music and they would never be performed in his lifetime. And it wasn't until 150 years later that people rediscovered his music in the late 20th century. So if you do have a chance and you like, you know, you like Bach, you like classical music, you like Baroque music, look up the music of Jan Dismas Zelenka. He is an amazing composer, and I'm really glad that his music has been rediscovered just in the last 40 or 50 years here.
Nice. I'll have to check that out because Bach is my favorite composer.
Yeah. I mean, or we'll see. Maybe Zelenka.
Maybe Zelenka.
Yeah.
I will let you all know next time if Zelenka has replaced Bach.
Yeah.
Be a Zelenka stan.
I will say, Victor, I was expecting you a little more enthusiasm when we started talking about this episode, because I know how a huge Rodney fan you are.
Oh, yeah.
And then you're a huge Zelenka fan. So I was like, waiting for you to just be fangirling all over the place.
Their chemistry isn't quite there yet, because they're kind of mediated through Weir. But we do get to see Zelenka, you know, just talking in Czech where nobody understands them, you know, and then Rodney, you know, not even acknowledging that he exists pretty much. But yet it's his solution that helps save the day. So, yeah, no, I'm very excited. But just their relationship and their chemistry, I think, is one of the delights of the show coming up.
Yeah, I've really enjoyed how, like, just the chemistry and the different personalities on Atlantis so far, and how they interact with each other, and how it's much less military than SG-1 was. So you get a lot more of the idiosyncrasies of the characters.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Dr. Kavanaugh even calls that out, where you know, he's part of the team, or leads the team of the scientists who's trying to figure out how to solve this problem of the puddle jumper being stuck in the gate and half, you know, dematerialized. And he's of course concerned with, well, what if the puddle jumper does come through the gate and blows up and it'll take out half the city or something. Mm-hmm. And Dr. Weir calls him out and said, that's not the problem we're trying to solve. You know, stop worrying about your own behind and worry about the people on the puddle jumper. And so we get this great scene where, he follows Weir out of the conference room and basically says, you know, what was that? What were you doing? You know, like, I left the SGC because it was run by the military, and I thought things would be different here under civilian rule. And she basically has to say, here in this, you know, colony, I'm the governor. And if you don't like it, we get some great lines, though. You're like, you busted me down like a private, you know? And of course, the commentary, not very helpful, was with, Rachel Luttrell and Paul McGillan, who plays, Carson Beckett. And they were noting the chemistry between Kavanaugh and Weir. So if there are some Kavanaugh Weir shippers out there, I guess. But
really?
Like, if you watch the scene again, you can kind of see that,
I was watching that. I kept thinking, I know people like this.
Yeah.
I've worked with people like this.
I used to work, this is my first job. I worked with a guy who was, 100% Kavanaugh. He was the Linux admin for our company. And
ponytail?
I feel bad saying this, because he fit the stereotype of the Linux admin, which I feel like Kavanaugh kind of does. And
yeah.
I was learning how to use, like, running bash, I think it was like bash scripts or something. And I didn't know what I was doing, because I'd never used it before. And he was like just the most condescending person in the world. And I kind of got flashbacks of that from Kavanaugh there, but I don't say any of that to demean Linux admins. I use Linux myself. So there you go. But yeah.
No. And if you want to have a really successful career, apparently be the jerk on shows that people love to hate, because Ben Cotton has probably, like, of all the Vancouver actors, probably like one of the most impressive, you know, list of IMDb credits. Most recently, I think, or not even most recently, he was on Resident Alien, the Alan Tudyk show, kind of in the same character, just the jerk, you know, ex-boyfriend to one of the other characters. So, it's a good, if that's going to be your type, you know, you'll always get work, apparently.
Yeah. I feel like that'd be a fun character to play, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, he's on a show that I watch currently. Oh, I'm gonna have to
He doesn't have the long hair, and he's, you know, basically my age. So he's.
Huh. We also get Holling interrupting Weir to bring up the the death rituals of the people from the planet for Tayla, and he wants to send her through like this. It's like a ceremonial bowl and looked like a tea set almost, and she has to point out to him that sending her this is basically telling everybody in the pod that they're going to die, and that would be terrible for morale, and it would basically cause them to give up. And I like how you see both sides of the characters' points of view. Like, she wants to be respectful of their traditions and their beliefs, but the reality of the situation is that would be a terrible idea.
Yeah. I like, it reminded me of Braytech because, you know, Holling says it's unusual in our culture to know the time of your death. And, you know, which with the callings and everything else, I can see that. And then Braytech, how many times in SG-1 was like, now we prepare to die. Like, you know, mm-hmm. he was just always, you know, not scared of death. Like, we're just, this is it. It's, you know, it's okay. And I feel like Holling, they had the same kind of thing. Like, okay, we accept our fate. It's happening. And Weir very clearly points out, no. We humans from Earth, we fight this.
Yeah.
Yeah. And apparently they added that scene in late. It wasn't, I don't know if it was in the original script or not, but they may have needed more time. And so they added that in. And I love where it comes. You know, I think she's just had like a bad meeting with the scientist or something. And she's just like, just let me get back over here. And then Holling interrupts her and contrasts that with how this like would have been handled in Star Trek The Next Generation, where, you know, Picard would have said, oh, sure, we'll honor your death rituals. Let's send the bowl over or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. But she's like, no, I respect your rituals. But this sends entirely the wrong message to these people we're trying to save here.
Yeah, I think it'd be different if Taylor was on the ship going like, would you send me the tea party thing right now? Because I need to prepare. No, she wasn't.
Yeah, she was focused on the bug on Shepard's neck.
Exactly.
Speaking of actors in different roles, I just realized that Christopher Heyerdahl, who plays Holling, he plays the military general in the Monarch show. That's like the Godzilla show.
Oh, and cool.
It's funny because he's obviously he's 20 something years older, but he's just such a different character because here he's almost like he comes across as very earthy and almost like hippie-ish, I guess you could say.
Yeah.
But in that he's like this, you know, hardcore military general. So it's fun to see the range that he has. Like, it's very impressed by that.
Cool.
That's excellent. Yeah.
And I got to say, like effects wise, I was pretty impressed with the weird bug. Like, It's hard to do like physical props on a budget well, and most TV shows don't really have like a huge budget to do that. But doing an insect is nice because you've got a lot of hard surfaces anyways, and they got like that gross, like they did a good job with the weird pulsing thing underneath.
Yeah.
It is, at one point starts like swelling, and it was just very visceral. And this is definitely my favorite weird bug attached to someone. My least favorite one is the giant beetle from Doctor Who, which, yeah, but.
Yeah, we do see more of the bug, although as the cast referred to it as like kind of one of those plastic lobsters you see on the wall at Red Lobster or something. But but I guess they had a lot more familiarity with it. But we do get a really excellent scene with Dr. Beckett, you know, back in sick bay, and the way they cut between the two of these. So they have their first aid kit on the puddle jumper, and they basically have to save Major Shepard's life with whatever's in this first aid kit. So, you know, they have just what's in this first aid kit. And so in order to help them back in Atlantis, the medical team, you know, all the scientists and doctors are all gathered around. They have the same medical kit, you know, there to represent, you know, whatever they have access to. So, you know, we're on the puddle jumper. They empty out the medical kit. We see the contents of the medical kit. But it turns out we're actually on Atlantis, and it's the doctors in Med Bay, you know, looking at the same stuff. And so I thought that was kind of cool. So they, you know, flip through, does iodine work? No. Does alcohol work? No. Mm-hmm. Does salt work? No. But when you pour the water, you know, and the salt water on it, so, you know, maybe they're the aliens from Signs or something, but spoiler alert. But, you know, maybe it's something like that. But that, you know, I do like how they're troubleshooting, you know, multiple problems, mm-hmm. first with the puddle jumper, but also with Major Shepard, and, you know, all the teams are involved and in coordinating that. So, like I said, everybody has a hand in the solution, and it's really cool.
Yeah.
It was very much an Apollo 11.
Yeah.
You know, type of solution that they, you know, I don't know if you remember in the movie that they, you know, walk in and they dump it on the table and say, this is what they have. We have to make this, what was it? A round air filter fit into this square hole, or if it was a square into a round, I can't remember exactly, but you know, they did that. And this episode was sort of the same way. In Apollo 11, you had the Gary Sinise character in the simulator running simulations on how to restart everything. And here you had Zelenka in the, you know, in an actual puddle jumper trying to figure it out. And so, I don't know. It was kind of, I like those kinds of things where they don't just come up with some magical solution that they're actually trying to work through while the people on the ship are trying to work through.
Yeah. No, that's the first thing I thought of when they poured everything out on the table and were comparing. Is like, this is just like that scene in Apollo 13. So,
oh, was it 13?
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, 13. Apparently they, and I just checked on the wiki, and apparently this, that was a reference that was intentional, is paralleling Apollo 13. So there we go.
There we go. They succeeded because we got
Yes, exactly.
Exactly. I guess the bug is called the Eratus bug. I had to look up the name because we just call it the big nasty bug. But apparently that means angry bug.
Oh.
There we go.
Angry bug.
Yeah.
Yeah. And this is the first hint, you know, that the Wraith evolved from the bug. You know, they mentioned like, oh, the Wraith had to evolve from something. Probably it's this bug. And we'll learn more about that. But we get to revisit the planet of the Wraith and, you know, the big, I guess they didn't realize it was a ship, but, you know, the base that they were in the first episode, it's gone. And the mountain where it was is just completely hollowed out. And they're like, oh, that was a ship. And it took off and flew away and apparently left some of the Wraith guards, the ones who wear the masks, behind. And those poor actors apparently had to run through the woods and stuff wearing these masks where they really couldn't see anything and were just like crashing into each other and into the trees, and the rest of the cast was laughing at them. But
they get hazard pay.
Yeah. But I like the way it's told in flashbacks. You're like, don't you remember? Like, they must have shot at our nacelles or something, you know?
Yeah.
I like the moment when they all realize it was a ship and Taylor says they've left and they're going to start calling.
Yeah.
And that was a really kind of, you know, good moment because you start realizing the gravity of what they've done by waking them up.
Yeah.
So it was, you could just see it on all their faces. That was pretty good.
Although I will say that I misheard her saying coaling is colon at first. And since the Wraith are very vampire-like, I was kind of worried that we were going to get a Twilight crossover.
Yeah, no.
Not the Collins. And, yeah, and then another great moment where in one of the flashbacks, you know, Shepard has the bug on his neck and he's found by one of the Wraith guards. Mm-hmm. And the Wraith guard just looks at him and just walks away because basically, like, you're doomed. You know, what that bug's going to do to you is far worse than anything I could do to you. And
there's nothing left for him.
Yeah.
Yeah, he doesn't want any seconds, I guess.
Yeah.
Which leads to the moment that, you know, Shepard tells that story when he's trying to get Weir to listen because he has something he wants to say in case he doesn't make it. And he's saying, I'm not going to make it because the way the Wraith guard responded. And of course, he doesn't get to say it. And at the end, she asks him, so what were you going to say?
Yeah.
And he says, like, what does he say? He says, like, I think we should all be kind to one another.
Yeah, be kind to one. Yeah, be excellent to each other.
Is that a Bill and Ted's reference?
Yeah. But, yeah. And they're like, that's not what you're going to say. So this is back when they were like, kind of will they, won't they, Shepard and Weir, I think.
Yeah. They were setting them up relationship, but I mean, it doesn't turn into a romantic relationship. They just always have this really strong, friendship, we'll say.
Yeah. It does feel like that's what they're trying to set up as them as an item, but I don't know. He also seemed to be macking pretty hard on Taylor in the first episode too. So that might just be how Shepard is.
Yeah.
And I wonder if, and I haven't read anything about this, and so I don't know, but I wonder if the showrunners were thinking like, let's see who he has chemistry with and let's see who, if the fans, after all the Sam Jack stuff, you know, it on SG-1, were they like, let's just see how the fans respond to these and if there's something out there. But I guess there wasn't. I don't know.
And we get the solution to the bug is shock Shepard with a defibrillator. Can't say that word right, apparently. Shock him with the thing that stops your heart. So his heart will stop and the bug will think he's dead. And try to kickstart his heart, if you will. Get him back to life. And of course, that doesn't work. So they have to put him into suspended animation, essentially, by taking him through the Stargate so he can sit in the little floating data things that Barclay's afraid of.
Yeah, the Teal'c was in for 48 hours. And
that's right.
Teal'c interrupted episode. Yeah. Yeah. It's a great solution too, because like one by one, like we lose the cast members, right? Mm-hmm. Like Taylor has to drag Shepard into the event horizon. You know, Rodney has to go so Ford can open up, can depressurize the puddle jumper and push him through the gate, which is the solution Kavanaugh came up with, you know, at the last second. So no, I really like it. I really like how all the pieces kind of come together at the end. And, you know, it is just a really good team episode.
Yeah. It does make me wonder, though. I feel like there should have been some sort of fail safe to prevent this exact kind of situation happening. But I don't know.
Well, also, another thing I really like about this is that when the episode first starts and, you know, Malvin and Stackhouse are derezzed or, you know, and dematerialized. And you're just like, well, if they shut off the gate, won't they like come through the other side of the gate or something? And you're like, can't they just do that? And then Carson, Dr. Beckett, essentially says, like, I'm just a medical doctor. I don't know how the gate works, but can't we just do that?
Yeah.
And they're like, no, you can't, because the gate processes everything as one object. And until the back end of it goes through, it won't send the whole thing through at once and stuff. So I did like how they kind of like, you're just like, can't this happen? And then one of the characters says, like, can't this happen? And
yeah, and they cut it off early the episode. So because you are thinking, well, can't they just all jump into the front and not worry about it? But yeah, they shut it down early. So there's no easy solution.
I do like that. Although I was expecting when we get that first scene after the credits where the guy's arm is hanging halfway out and he pulls him through. I was almost expecting for it to just be the arm.
I was like, poor Ford. Yeah.
But yeah, no, I liked that. And they... Even though my one nitpick about that explanation, which I think is a good explanation, is does that mean that it doesn't process the humans inside the ship as their own discrete objects? And it's just the whole package that comes through? But hey, whatever.
That would have ruined the episode.
Yeah.
Not gonna well actually it.
Yeah, I mean, this is the first time we've seen like actual conveyances that can go through the gate, you know, as a matter of course and stuff. Mm-hmm. So, plus Pegasus Galaxy gates might be different to a lot for the puddle jumpers or something. But yeah, I think, you know, we get a lot of really good kind of explanations to get Dr. Grodin in it and stuff too, or just Grodin and a lot of really good stuff going on.
And we're so early.
Yeah,
I mean, I think IMBD counts as four. Because they counted Rising as, I think, two episodes. Yeah. I can't remember. I mean, we're so early in this first season. And it's exciting at how much they already have established, you know, characters, elements to all the technology, the, you know, the big bad threat that's out there. I mean, they're working hard to get us hooked in fast.
Yeah.
This is the only episode of Atlantis that the director, Mario Azzopardi, directed. He directed one episode of SG-1 as well as the pilot of SG-1. So, Korai, the one where Teal'c's on trial way back in season one. So, he did a really good job with his episode, I think, just keeping the tension and the momentum going.
Mm-hmm. Right. I don't think there's ever a moment where you're like, that scene was unnecessary. Or
no.
I mean, you're just... The whole thing, you're glued. What's going to happen next?
Yeah, it passed the, I did not feel like I wanted to just check my phone while watching it test. So that was always good. Awesome. Do we have any fun alternate language titles for this one?
Good episode, but no fun titles. Everything pretty much worked out to be just 38 minutes. Yeah, so sorry about that, folks. We'll try harder next week.
Try harder to make
make
some different languages come up. Mm-hmm. Awesome. Before we go, we'd like to take a moment to make it possible to thank our patrons who make it possible for us to create The Secret to Stargate. Their generous donations at sqpn.com/give make it possible for us to continue The Secret to Stargate and all the shows at StarQuest, and you can join them by visiting sqpn.com/give. Be sure to follow the show on Apple Podcasts, TuneIn, Spotify, iHeartRadio, and you can find our video versions where you can see Victor's unfortunate hanger-on, shall we say, at youtube.com/StarQuestMedia. And to find previous episodes of Secret to Stargate and to send us feedback, please visit sqpn.com/stargate. You can email us at stargate@sqpn.com and follow StarQuest on social media at facebook.com/starquestmedia or on Twitter at sqpn. And we'll be back next time when we'll be discussing the next episode of SG-1, Icon. Until then, Lisa Jones, thank you for joining me in sharing the secret to Stargate.
Thanks, Jack.
And Victor Lambs, thank you as well.
Thanks, Jack, and stop talking, please.
Well, then, I'll just say thank you to your neck bug, then. Thank you, neck bug. And once again, I'm Jack Brozini. Thank you for listening to The Secret to Stargate on StarQuest.
Anyway, I'm sorry, but that just happens to be how I feel about it. What do you think?
Here's another show on the StarQuest Network you're sure to enjoy. The Secrets of Star Trek. Find it wherever fine podcasts are found or at sqpn.com/StarTrek.